Welcome to episode 115 of Industry Misinterpretations with James Robertson and Michael Lucas Smith. This week we interview James Blandy of Mozilla about the TraceMonkey jitter project that's being worked on at Mozilla for the next release of Firefox. This has implications for all dynamic languages, JavaScript and otherwise. If you like this week's podcast, please send feedback to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com or head on over to our Industry Misinterpretations group at Facebook, head on over to Podcast Alley, cast a vote for the podcast, and of course, subscribe at iTunes. This is James Robertson. I'm the product evangelist for Syncom Smalltalk. I'm here with Michael Lucas Smith, the lead on our Web Velocity project, and I've also got Jim Blandy, who... Go ahead, Jim. Tell us who you are.
I work for Mozilla Corporation on SpiderMonkey, which is Mozilla's open-source JavaScript JavaScript interpreter. Right now, we're working on putting in tracing JIT, which is a new kind of... just-in-time compilation technique that actually will work pretty well for dynamic languages like JavaScript. So that's what we're up to.
And that's why we got you on here. I recently got to see you present the TraceMonkey work at the PDX Funk group at CubeSpace. And it was a really interesting talk. So afterwards, I asked if you'd like to come onto our podcast and talk about it because, well, jitting, you know, was really... pioneered in the small talk world, and this is a new kind of way of jitting, and it was in many respects also pioneered by the same people behind all the small talk stuff with the self, and then those guys moved on to strong talk and then on to the hotspot JVM, and now it's sort of come full circle because JavaScript ECMAScript was based off self, and you're putting this technique into JavaScript and Firefox, so it's got a really interesting history. Would you like to correct and fill in the gaps that all the bits I got wrong there? Or?
Yeah, sure. As I understand it, Brendan Eich and Jamie Zielinski were both at Netscape back when the web was new, and Brendan Eich had this idea that we really got to put a scripting language that people can include little snippets of code in web pages, and then it will run on the browser, and we can use this to sort of help the web pages interact with the user in a nice way. And Jamie Zielinski, who's always this fanatic about releasing quickly and just can't tolerate any kind of delays of that sort, said, well, if you can do it in 2 weeks, that's okay, but no longer than that. If it's not done in 2 weeks, forget it. And so Brendan,
so there was no pressure or anything.
Yeah. No pressure. Well, I mean, if you know anything about Jamie Zielinski, you know that he's a pretty intense guy that way. And so Brendan had 2 weeks to pound something out. So he took the syntax of Java, because he figured that was the up and coming thing and that everybody would know it, and combined it with the semantics of self, sort of as best as he could. And there was a very slapdash job, but the thing is, there was just this huge explosion, and there's really no way to communicate effectively with the vast group of people that are writing code in JavaScript. So the language, you really just can't change anything about its behavior, because then you break the whole web. So what we have is we have this language that was designed and implemented in 2 weeks, which we then can't touch, and it's this it is the language for client-side scripting on the web. I think the closest competition is probably ActionScript these days, which is in fact which is what goes in Adobe Flash. And ActionScript is actually a variant of JavaScript. Adobe took JavaScript and they added type annotations to it, which allow them to generate pretty good code.
There's also JScript, which is Microsoft's interpretation of JavaScript, right?
I don't actually know about JScript. The thing about it is Microsoft is as constrained by compatibility issues as everybody else.
They don't seem to notice that.
Well, I think I know where Jim's coming from. They're effectively constrained no matter what they want.
Right. Their monopoly power doesn't give them the kind of freedom to dictate where the language is going that it does in other areas. For reasons that I don't really understand, Java has not really taken off as a client-side script, as a client-side extension language for the web. I think maybe it has to do with performance and startup time, but I really don't know. So JavaScript is really where it's at. The thing about it is that JavaScript is a highly dynamic language. It's based around the idea of an object, and an object is just a set of properties that have values, right? You know, if you had a point, it would have two properties, x and y, and they would each have values, which were the coordinates. But you can take any object and you can just add new properties to it at any time, and you can delete properties from it at any time. There's no, it's not static at all. The shapes of these things can change at any moment. Then each object can have a prototype, which is another object that it inherits properties from, right? So if you've got one object, with properties X, Y, and its prototype has a property Z, then you can, if you ask for the value of property Z on the first object, then it'll say, okay, this one doesn't have a Z. I'm going to walk up the prototype chain and see that, oh, well, here, its prototype has a Z, and so that's the value I'm going to use. So you get this, instead of having classes that fix what sort of data members objects have and have provide all the methods for the object, instead of having classes, what you instead have is something that's wildly dynamic. Whatever property values an object has can change from moment to moment. You can stick new properties on the prototype, and then those properties become visible to every object that's based on that prototype. Prototypes can have prototypes, right? So you can have a chain of these things going back. But as a result, it's very difficult for an ahead-of-time compiler to get a handle on what's going on, right? The user writes foo.x. What code do you generate for that? What's the offset of x in the foo object? Is it even in that foo object, or is it, in one of its prototypes, something up its prototype chain? So it's really unfriendly to static compilers. Hostile.
So, I mean, JavaScript has typically been a reasonably slow language, though, and right. Of late, a lot of JavaScript has started making its way onto the internet. I think there's been, in recent times, a kind of renaissance of JavaScript where libraries like jQuery and Prototype and MooTools have made using JavaScript across browser implementations much easier.
Yeah, MochiKit.
But then Apple started a war by making Safari run fast, making JavaScript run fast. And they're basically compiling JavaScript in some fashion before it runs.
Well, they had a very good interpreter. And nowadays they do have a JIT, but what they started with was a very good interpreter. I guess the way I would tell the story is, this is the way I presented it in the talk at PDX Funk. I said this is a talk about performance, right? But the first question you should ask when somebody starts talking to you about performance is, why do you care, right? Because there are a lot of situations where performance just doesn't matter, right? If you write something simple and it works fine, then you shouldn't spend your time trying to make it faster. And then if you're going to talk about language performance, well, everybody knows that choosing the right algorithm, often has an effect which dwarfs the quality of the implementation of the language.
Oh, sure. This is all old news to us small talk guys. We've been preaching this particular sermon for eons now, and it's
exactly. Our language is beautiful and expressive, and so you can write the code the way it really ought to be written. You can reach sophisticated algorithms because our language doesn't get in your way, and so the actual performance of the implementation is secondary. And then, you know, obviously, you know, in the web, a lot of times you say, well, look, I'm bound by the bandwidth, I'm bound by the latency of the net, and so, you know, shaving off a few milliseconds in user response time doesn't matter. And then when you're dealing with humans only have a certain ability to notice things. Once you've got something that's fast enough for humans, you just don't care.
And a lot of the time in a web browser is spent doing the actual rendering. Layout, interpretation.
Or talking to the database on the back end, in which case it just doesn't matter, because if you're stuck in a query, it doesn't really matter how fast your bytecodes are executing.
Yeah. But the interesting thing, and this is where I think the story really starts, is that, whenever you have some situation where everything's sort of fast enough, well, people will try to push it. Right, everybody's trying to push the envelope, and like you have Google releasing Gmail, and you know Google Maps, and you know Facebook wants to have as much you know quick interaction on its pages, you know that it can cram in there. So, however fast the JavaScript implementation is, somebody's always going to sort of pack in as much as they can, and you know the time comes when they're going to add one more feature, and they say, "Oh man, that's just too slow. I can't stand it anymore. I guess we'll leave that out." Right? So what happens is the efficiency, the quality of the language implementation, the speed of the language interpretation, determines how much room web developers have to work in, and people will always use up as much room as they've got. Right, and this is not a new thing, right? Processors have been getting faster and faster over the last 20 years, but word processors are still slightly sluggish, just like they were when they were first released.
Actually, right? I'd go so far as to say that most word processors are slower than they were back in 1994. But
exactly, exactly. And so all that speed, right? All that speed that Intel has given us and AMD and that gang has been absorbed by us programmers. The faster they can speed it up, the faster we can waste it.
Because you go back and program on a Commodore 64, where you don't have that much time, you don't have that much memory, you have to get really tricky about how you squeeze the most out of the machine. But when you don't have to get tricky about stuff, you write the simplest thing that could possibly work, which is often a very dumb algorithm that's a complete waste of time. And then that code lives on for the next 10 years.
Yeah, but the fact is, the reason that people care about technology is that it does cool new things, right? What they want is a cool new thing that works well enough.
Well, that's right? Kind of the interesting thing to me about JavaScript is that for years, seemingly, JavaScript kind of skated along as the thing you use to put animations on your web page, and that was pretty much it. And then suddenly, a few years ago, people rediscovered, I can't say discovered because it had been there forever, they rediscovered the XML HTTP request thing. And then suddenly it was like this old technology had been pushed forward and said, oh, look at all these cool things we could do if only we did this. And then that skated along for a while. And then, like Michael said, when Safari came out, suddenly there got to be this big push to make JavaScript faster. But it was kind of dormant for years and years, and then all of a sudden it just took off.
Yeah. I mean, I think, like I say, I think what happened is the apps came along that made JavaScript performance matter, and then Safari responded to that by providing something that really performed very well. And since that point, Firefox and Safari have been sort of leapfrogging each other in performance.
I really want to talk about the tracing JIT, but I have to bring up the Google Chrome V8 engine as well.
Right.
Because it was a surprise. I mean, was it a surprise to you guys? Did you know it was coming?
Yeah, I certainly didn't know that they were working on it. I mean, I'm relatively new to Mozilla, but I didn't know that the V8 people were going to do it. Their JIT is a very different structure from ours. They don't have any interpreter at all. Apparently, they are actually generating code for every little bit that they execute.
Now we know the guys behind this stuff, because there was a group. They started with the Self and StrongTalk and the JVM, and then they went off and made a new VM called Resilient, or OOVM. And it got bought, and they used it for things like embedded systems in speakers. And when the speakers would have a problem, the customers could ring up the speaker company, and the speaker company could debug it over the phone and then send the patch over the internet to the speakers and patch them. Right, so they know all about the dynamic world. And that VM, OOVM, Resilient, got bought and just disappeared. And we had no idea what happened to this guy and his group until V8 came out. And it turns out now he's working at Google and he's doing that. So we know what they're capable of. And as you point out, it's they're starting from a practically a clean slate. They've as they say in their press release, I guess, is that they've got a proper garbage collection in there instead of all this weird reference counting. So you've got an interesting legacy to deal with, which makes the traditional jitting techniques not that applicable to SpiderMonkey.
Yeah.
And now you've got this trace jit, which I think is really interesting, which is what I really wanted to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah, well, okay. So let me get into that. So anyway, there is a need for performance. It's certainly a big marketing issue. People care about it. People know about it. And improving performance gives people more room to work on web apps. But JavaScript, like I've said, is a very dynamic language, and so it's hostile to most traditional compilation techniques. So the way tracing jits work, this is research done by Andreas Gall at UCI, and that's his last name is spelled G-A-L, and so you can search for him on the web and find his papers. And the essence of the idea is you take some kind of interpreter, like a bytecode interpreter, where you have a series of instructions, and you watch for backward branches. And for every instruction that's the target of a backward branch, you actually keep a counter on it, and you count how many times it has been backward branched to. When the counter crosses a certain threshold, then you continue to interpret, but you create a trace, which is a log of each instruction that you've executed. And so you're going along and you're interpreting, you're still running the code, but you're keeping a log, you're accumulating this log of each instruction that you've run. And if you find that you end up back at that backward branch target, which we're going to assume now as a loop head, it's the head of a loop, then you close off the trace, right? And you stop logging, and you compile that trace of instructions as a loop. Basically, so what we're doing is we're dynamically identifying loops, not loops in the source code. These may not correspond to loops in the source code. All that we've done is we've just recognized that control came to this place, and then it went someplace else, and then it came back. And obviously, we got thresholds for how long the trace can be. Otherwise, we give up. So we try to compile the trace that we've gotten, and wherever there was a branch which would have left that trace, but we didn't take that branch, we compile that into what we call a guard, which is a conditional instruction that checks the condition. And if the condition would bring us off trace, then what we do is we reconstruct the state of the interpreter. We sort of have to fail back into the interpreter because we've gone off our trace. We have to reconstruct the state the interpreter would have had, and then we jump back into the interpreter and keep going, right? But the fact that we've actually observed control following along this path means that it's likely to be, in practice, a loop that we're going to go around many times. So simply compiling this single linear trace that's full of all these branches that go off, but they're unlikely. So the processor will predict them well. We actually, even just using that very simple technique, just as described there, you can actually get very good performance. One of the things that Andreas Gall did is he implemented a Java, not JavaScript, a Java JIT. Java JITs are these huge things, right? They're real compilers. The code for them is 6 megabytes for one of them, and they're pretty heavyweight things to put on a mobile phone, right? And they take a lot of resources, and the startup is slow because the processors aren't that fast on those phones to begin with. And, you know, it's the user's battery you're using up. Mm. So anyway, so he, as an alternative to that, he took a Java bytecode interpreter and implemented this kind of tracing JIT for it. And with a total code space, or a total memory consumption of 150K, and that includes both code and, you know, a cache of these traces that he detected and compiled, using a total of 150K of memory, he got very significant speedups. Right. I mean, obviously, it depends on exactly what the code is. Right. Some code is going to be amenable to trace jitting. Some code isn't. But basically, with this tiny impact in terms of, you know, memory consumption, in terms of processor consumption, he got a significant portion of the benefit of this really heavyweight jit back.
In the Smalltalk world of optimization, the jits that we have, we'll JIT a method. So an entry point into a method is transformed into machine code. And then when that method leaves, or it jumps to another method that's also JITed, you know, it goes back into the interpreter. So that's there's this problem with this approach, and that's the general approach used by almost every JIT around, is that optimizing across methods, inlining code, that kind of thing, is actually pretty hard to do it well.
Right. And that is one of the things that the tracing JIT handles very, very well.
Well, I mean, it almost just ignores it because it's not looking at method boundaries at all.
Right. Here's the thing to notice, right? When your trace, suppose you've got a loop, right? And the loop contains a function call. Well, your trace will show, okay, here we're starting the loop, and okay, now we're going to this function, right? And now we're coming back out of that function, and now we're at the bottom of the loop, and now we go back up to the top of the loop, we check the condition, and then we keep going, right? Okay, so the trace just naturally sort of pulls in the body of the function that was called, right?
Yeah.
You have to make some kind of check that the function hasn't been redefined, right? So the actual JITed code that you will get will, you know, do the start of the loop, and then there will be a test to make sure that the function's definition is still, you know, it's still at that address, right, or whatever. And then, you know, but that test is going to be very easily predictable for the processor because it's always going to be true, right? And so then you just continue on in your trace. So your trace just sort of naturally does inlining. And you can even inline dynamic method dispatches, right? Dispatches where you're going into something where the actual code that's going to be run depends on the type of the thing whose method you're invoking, because what you'll get JITed is a test on the class of the thing that's being invoked, and then you just keep going if the class is the one that you expected to see. So basically, the natural behavior of the JIT gets you function inlining, and it also gets you a virtual function call inlining, if I can use the C++ terminology, right?
Sure.
You get dynamic dispatch, inlining across dynamic dispatches, which is something that you know, traditional compilers really have to sweat to get. Because they have to, you know, they have to prove everything ahead of time, right? An ahead of time compiler has to, they can't make an optimization until they can prove that it's correct. The cool thing about a tracing JIT is that it's free to guess. It can say, you know, I think this is going to be true, and then just as long as it emits a check to check its assumptions, you can go with it. So it's a really...
You can almost say that you're getting this because you're not looking for it.
Yeah, well, one of the cool things about this is the,
that's
is
right.
the
we just
definition
sort of, don't
of a
it.
Loop, right? I mean, the definition of a loop is something that repeated back to a backward pointer. So that could be a tell recursion. It could actually be a for loop. It could actually be exceptions throwing themselves back to an outer loop. You know, it could even start in the middle of a method in a closure, right? It doesn't have to be anywhere.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things. I didn't have time to put this together to try this out for the PDX Funk talk. But one of the examples that I wanted to try, and I think this will work, is you could even have a loop which starts in one function, then returns to its caller, who then calls that function that contains the loop head again.
So an inside out loop.
And as long as you get back to, you could have an inside out loop. You could have a loop. You could. I don't know. You don't want to call that inlining function calls. You want to call that inlining function returns. Right. I mean, you could do it. I haven't tried it out, but then there's there the last trick, which I think is pretty important for real world stuff, if you've got this tiny mobile device, then what I've described so far is probably enough. But in practice, one of the things you want to do is when you're going along on a trace and then you hit a guard instruction and you go off trace, you want to JIT, you want to start recording again.
Right. So the fallback can enter into a new trace, which is also jitted. So
right.
A fallback can fall into another JIT.
Right. You fall off the trace. You fall off your what you've jitted. You start a new recording, and then you trace that, and then you take that new thing and you link it back in. So over time, what starts out as a linear code path actually ends up being a tree. Right, and you start at the loop head. The root of the tree is the head of the loop, and then every leaf of the tree is branching back up to the root. And that way, you end up being able to encompass a lot more code on trace. Now, the thing about it is, when you go off trace, even if you can't fit the control flow into sort of this kind of tree pattern, although the tree pattern covers a lot more than you'd think. Even when your control flow doesn't fit into your tree pattern, all that's really happening is, okay, so you have to go off trace, you recreate the interpreter state, you fall back into the interpreter. Well, the interpreter can then maybe, you know, start recording a new trace right there, right? So, you know, maybe all you have is you just have sort of an ugly transition between one bit of traced code, one bit of jitted code, and another bit of jitted code, where you reconstruct the interpreter state and then you immediately use that to start a new piece of jitted code. So, you know, there's a lot of you can actually cover quite a bit just using trace trees. So the JIT which we have in Firefox right now, or we're trying real hard to get it into the next release. It wasn't in 3.0. It uses trees. It generates trace trees, but it also generates something which the guys who are really knee deep in this stuff, they know about it, but I don't understand it too well. They're talking about nested trees, and I gather that would be something where one branch of a tree could.
Well, I would assume that would mean that
trees are implicitly trees are always nested, so I'm not really sure what it means.
Well, I would guess that it would mean that if you fall out of one condition into another tree, you can escape from that tree back into the main loop again, to basically save space as you know that.
I'm not really sure.
I just want to change directions here again. I mean, the V8 Chrome is now out of beta. How, I mean, this the war is barely, but I think the war is, the speed war is just heating up here because the Chrome stuff is really fast. So how does TraceMonkey compare to the latest V8 benchmarks?
I don't know what the latest numbers are, but at some point during the summer we were faster than V8. It's not the case. It is not the case that V8 simply blows us out of the water and we can't catch up. It really is a case of leapfrogging. At some point during the summer, we were faster than V8, and I don't know where things stand now. Squirrel Fish released Squirrel Fish Extreme, I think it's called.
That's the Apple one, right?
That's the one that's jitting. I've read the paper that they linked to, and it didn't look that impressive to me. But you know, it's just hard to tell.
How does this compare, say, to what the Apple guys are doing with Safari and what the IE guys are doing? I mean, are you and Google just way ahead of them at this point in terms of JavaScript performance, or are they catching up?
Squirrelfish is Safari.
Okay.
So when I say that, when I talk about Squirrelfish having a JIT, then that's what I'm talking about. I believe that the new Squirrelfish JIT is not going to do as well as either V8 or TraceMonkey. But that's, you know, they're smart guys. They're working hard. It's a very competitive environment, and we've got really good players on all teams. And I just wouldn't want to say ahead of time that Squirrelfish is dead or anything like that. That's just not gonna work. They're gonna do very well. And the thing about it is, I mean, it creates a lot of pressure on, the participants in the race. Microsoft is the one that really hasn't been participating, but they are starting to wake up, and they've, you know, they've announced sort of a rejuvenation of the IE project.
Whatever that means. So, I mean, they've said that a few times now.
Well, I mean, you know, it's Microsoft. It's hard to tell because they have so much resources, but then they have so much inertia, and you just never really tell where it's going to go. I think they'll probably do a good job if it turns out to be competitively important to them.
I think in the past they were really hoping that Silverlight would be their silver bullet that would get them out of having to play at all.
Well, right. Actually, I mean, they've been sort of wanting the web to stay rather static. They've never been enthusiastic about JavaScript becoming, you know, becoming as powerful as it has, because they really want to lock people into, you know, one of their solutions and make sure that everybody has to use Microsoft tools in order to participate in the web. But thankfully that hasn't been the way it's turned out. And you know, we at Mozilla we hope we can take some credit for that. But right, Microsoft has a lot of catching up to do, but they also have a lot of resources and they have a lot of smart people. So they might be able to do it. But right now I think the main people in the lead are us, Chrome, and with the WebKit guys, the Safari people. But the thing about it is, even though it makes life difficult for us, it's great for the end users, right? The users of the web, they all, the people on the web are the ones who win. So
here's the interesting conspiracy side to all this stuff, though. So now Google has Chrome with V8. Here's a factoid. And I'm curious what your take on it is. 56 million of the 66 million that Mozilla made in 2006 came from Google.
That's right.
So, I mean, I think that's great, but...
I mean, I'm not saying that those numbers are right, but basically, I mean, Mozilla gets the bulk of its income from Google.
Yeah, I mean, so what happens if Google basically decides... I mean, It seems like it would be very difficult for a lot of the Mozilla initiatives to continue if Google basically decided, no, we can do this stuff ourselves.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. It's certainly something that Mitchell Baker and the Mozilla leadership think about carefully. Mozilla has been careful to put itself in a solid financial condition. So, you know, it's not like, you know, if Google decides to change its mind, we just cease to exist at that instant. And we did sign, just sort of almost concurrently with the release of Chrome, Google and Mozilla reaffirmed their commitment then with a 3-year contract. So, you know, for at least the next 3 years. But in the end, I really don't think that Google really isn't Microsoft. I'm not, you know, going to be Pollyanna about it and say that they're all, you know, they're never going to do anything bad. I mean, but I really don't think that Google thinks the way Microsoft thinks.
Well, moreover, I don't think it's in their interest. I mean, honestly, one of the things they really like is having the default search option in any Mozilla-based browser be Google. And if they told you guys to take a hike, that would kind of be counter to their interests. So it's a win-win the way I look at it.
Well, I mean, so here's the scenario. The scenario is that Chrome becomes a widely used browser, right? Then Google doesn't need... I guess the thought would be that maybe Google wouldn't need to have, you know, to have Firefox out there. But actually, I think that's... I just don't think that's going to happen. I mean, I think we've got a really good group of people working on it, working on Firefox. I think we've you know, Mozilla certainly has come through tough times. It's not like, you know, we've never had difficulties. The startup of Mozilla was extremely rocky, and we came through it. We pulled together, and we've got a good team. We've got good processes. So I think Firefox is going to continue to be something that has significant market share. I think Chrome will compete with that, but I don't think it's going to knock us out. And so, yeah, I think that Google will need to will continue to need will continue to benefit from having Firefox refer searches to Google. But the other thing is Google's whole thing. I mean, look at what Android is. Google didn't work on Android because they want to be a cell phone company. They worked on Android because they realized that the cell phone network is drastically underutilized, because the cell phone companies are desperate to squeeze every last bit of revenue out of their customers that they can. I mean, the amount of stuff that's happening on those wireless networks is ridiculous. It's you know, people talk about how much it is, but it could be so much more. And Google sees that, and Google wants to expand the universe of things that people can do with the mobile networks. Because if more people are using the net, Google's going to make more money, right? And so it's a very, I mean, that's the advantage of having a business model that's based on this automatic fountain of cash, right? Which is what Google basically is, right? It's not like somebody out there is selling each one of those ads. You know, it's all automatic. As long as they keep everything going, then, you know, as long as the searches are good, then the money comes in. And so they're in a position where they can really take a long-term view of things and say, look, we want the web to be as accessible to as many people as possible. We want people to be turning to the web for practically everything, because as long as that's what's going on, Google wins. And as far as Mozilla is concerned, as long as Google is doing well, then Mozilla's income is going to be okay. So the real question is, does Google perceive Firefox and Mozilla as a significant force in opening up the web to more people and keeping the web free? And I think the answer is obviously yes. Right, by making sure that the web is not something that's owned by Microsoft, you know, we keep it, we make a big difference. So I think that we're...
I can say for sure that Firefox is my favorite web browser, and I use it all the time. I prefer it over Safari. So I really thank your efforts in SpiderMonkey, and TraceMonkey is really interesting. I think we're at... time's almost up here. So...
Well, actually, let me get one piece of roadmap out before we wrap up. So right now, with the current release of Firefox, you don't have TraceMonkey in that, correct?
The 3.0 release does not.
Okay, and what release are you targeting to get TraceMonkey in?
Well, okay, TraceMonkey is actually in the main sources right now, and I
so it's in your development builds.
Oh yeah, it's totally in, you know, when everybody's it is not. Oh, see, I'm sorry. I didn't keep track of all this stuff. The code is there, but it is not enabled by default. You have to go into the about config thing and turn on the right switches. If you have a post 3.0 release, I think you actually have it in there. Sorry, what were you saying?
But there's a version called Minefield. It that's the version that comes with it on by default.
Well, yeah, Minefield is just what you get when you build the Mozilla sources by default. It always calls itself Minefield, and because we don't want to have random builds out there advertising themselves as Firefox. It's bad for the brand.
Right. I ran a version of Minefield once, and it used up all the shared memory handles on my Mac and killed it.
Well, that's why they call it Minefields, right? I mean, that's exactly we want to make people aware. You know, look, you are not, this is not a product, right? This is research. This is an intermediate phase. Our product is Firefox, and it has been tested. And so we don't even call it Firefox unless it has been tested. We are hoping to turn on the JIT by default in the next release, but that depends at least in small part on how soon I can finish this call and get back to work. You know, we have a bunch of bugs that.
So when you say next release, are we talking 3.x or are we talking 4?
The 3.x.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, this is not a long-term thing. This is a short-term thing. I mean, I would be, you know, if we don't have it out there by the end of the year, then things, so something's going sour and
end of the year.
Real attention going to be paid.
Wow. That's a call.
Do you mean end of 2008 or are we talking 2009?
End of 2008.
Oh, okay. So,
cool.
I mean, we're starting. you know, actually, okay, I may be betraying a little bit more ignorance about our schedule than I should be. We are starting the beta process, the beta release process for the next big Firefox right now, for 3.1 right now.
Okay,
very good.
And so you know, our beta processes usually take, you know, however long, however many months it is. But yeah, but it's going to be the next big, we're trying to get into the next big release. That's what we're expecting. So.
Well, I think we should probably wrap it up here. Jim, thanks for coming on. It's really interesting stuff.
Should I give the link for the little bibliography I put together?
Well, we'll get James. James will put it in the podcast notes.
Well, go ahead and put it on in the audio, and I'll be happy to put it in the notes too.
It's http://tinyurl.com/jimb-tjit. That's jimby-tjit for Jim Blandy-tracing-jit at tinyurl.com.
Okay, just paste that into our Skype chat, and I'll make sure that gets into the notes.
So I know you hadn't listened to our podcast before I brought it up the other night, Jim. Have you had a chance to listen to any of it since?
No, I've been trying to work on these bugs. I really want to get it out.
Yep. And so did you enjoy yourself? Would you do this again?
Yeah, sure. It was fun.
Are you going to listen to this episode of the podcast?
I'm probably going to avoid it like the plague.
We get that answer a lot.
So.
Okay, well, yeah, thanks very much for coming on. Good luck with the upcoming release of TraceMonkey.
Okay.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
In this next segment, I have Dave Buck with this week's Cimbron Design Minute.
This is David Buck with today's Cimbron Design Minute. There's one aspect of programming which makes a big difference to the readability of the code, but is often overlooked. It's white space. There are two kinds of white space: horizontal space like tabs and spaces, and vertical space like blank lines. Developers are usually quite good at putting in horizontal space to line up statements within the same control structure. They often aren't quite as good at leaving vertical space by inserting blank lines. Both kinds of white space are important. Horizontal white space shows you the structure of the code, and vertical white space separates statements that belong together from statements which don't. You should use blank lines between sections of your code that do different things. Often, this encourages you to move lines around to make groups that belong together. You can then consider the next step of extracting them into a separate method. Even if you don't, the blank lines help convey your intentions and make your code more readable. This has been the Cimbron Design Minute. Cimbron offers training and consulting in object-oriented development and the Smalltalk programming language. For more information, visit www.cimbron.com or email info@cimbron.com.
In this segment, we have James Savage with the week's Smalltalk Jobs Report.
I'm James T. Savage, and this is the Smalltalk Jobs Report. Only a single new job in the USA this week, but I'll also highlight some open positions that have been in the database for a while. White House Station, New Jersey. Chubb has a permanent position for a senior programmer analyst who has insurance knowledge, excellent communication skills, and experience with JCL, IMS, VisualAge Smalltalk, VSAM, COBOL, and DB2. Experience that is considered a plus includes Java, MQ Series, Zeek, and TMF. Springfield, New Jersey. Precision System Design has a permanent position for a senior Smalltalk developer who also has experience with SQL and relational databases. Perth, Australia. Robert Waters is looking for a Smalltalk software engineer who also has experience with financial markets, C, C++, and Java. This permanent position pays up to 80,000 Australian per year. Ottawa, Ontario. Procom is looking for a senior system analyst who has experience with Eclipse, Gemstone, IMS, Java, Smalltalk, and Sybase. Mechelen, Belgium. Michael Page International has a contract position for a project engineer, software developer, who has experience with Java, Smalltalk, and C#. The jobs listed in this report are just a few examples of the Smalltalk positions that are currently open across the world. For more details, visit our public directory page at xrl.us/smalltalkjobs, or read my blog, Message Sends with an Undefined Object. Good luck with your job hunting.
Up next is Randall Schwartz with a quick look around the Squeak world with Squeak News.
This is Randall Schwartz here with your latest Squeak News. You can find all this news and more at news.squeak.org. John McIntosh has ported Newspeak's Aliens FFI implementation to Squeak. John notes that the port is in its early days, and more work and support will be needed to implement Aliens support across the full range of Squeak platforms. As a result of this interest in Aliens, Gilad Braca has written a post giving an overview of Aliens, the thinking that went into it, and how it works. FFI allows a programming language to make use of services written in another language, and Gilad suggests that the lack of a standard, fully featured FFI has been an ongoing problem for Smalltalk developers. In particular, John writes that, quote, Squeak's VM's existing FFI has been found to be buggy, bloated, and slow, end quote. John's code, under the Apache license, is available from Squeak Source, and more information on his implementation can be found at the Alien Swiki page. For Squeak Weekly News, this is Randall Schwartz. You can also check out my blog at methodsandmessages.vox.com.
If you enjoyed this week's podcast, please tell other people about it. We'd love to have more small talkers and more developers learning about Smalltalk through the Industry Misinterpretation podcast. If you have feedback, send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. Head on over to Facebook, join the Industry Misinterpretations group. Head on over to Ning and join the Small Talkers group. Or head on over to Podcast Alley and cast a vote for the podcast. In the meantime, have fun with Small Talk.